head.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life. This week, my guest comes all the way from London, England. He is Don Cupid. He's been called the most radical theologian in the world. He has written over 50 books. He talks to me about his latest one called Creative Faith, Religion as a Way of World Making. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up this morning on KBOO, it's a Veterans Voice with Marvin and Angie. The topic is houseless veterans in the Northwest, and their guest is Dawa Goes Behind. Chris Andre follows at 10 with Air Cascadia. At 10:15, we've got Flashpoints. At 11 o'clock, we've got the Radio Zine. Today, host Jennifer Kemp speaks with journalist Lou Urenik about his book, The Great Fire. And at 11:30, from the archives, we hear Follow the Garbage. It's a look at what happens to the stuff we throw away, produced by Lisa Loving and a crew of news volunteers. And we want you all to be members of KBOO if you can. You can become a member easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says Donate Today. And thank you in advance for doing that. And now we're going to get to Veterans Voice on KBOO Portland.
We live in violent times when the reasons don't quite rhyme. We watch the game and we tally up the score. But it's hard to count the cost. What's won and who has lost? When honesty is a casualty of war. And it's always been the plan of the ones who hold command to make the other side seem less than real. So we shout about our pride, and the deaths are justified, and we glorify the ones who do not feel. But I say don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. Don't fire till you hear the truth through the lies. Don't fire till you know the love in the heart of a mother's son. Until then, please don't fire your gun. Firing missiles on command, you don't have to watch them land. Pushing buttons in a video game war. Watching television screens, we don't have to hear the screams. But the people are still dying like before. So the graveyards are all filled with the ones who have been killed. And the families hear the words that they had feared. And we scream that we have won, while the mother mourns her son. And the battlefield is flooded with her tears. And I say, don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. And don't fire till you hear the truth through the lies. And don't fire till you know the love in the heart of a mother's son. Until then, please don't fire your gun. Generals of all times have only fought to rule the minds of the people who will make the bullets fly. So the soldiers go and fight for what they believe is right. And the ones who give the orders seldom die. And so we're left here with a choice. Will we hide or raise a voice? Will we fight a war or will we fight for peace? If there's one thing that I know, it's that the presidents won't go. Without the soldiers, all the wars will cease. They'll cease. And I say, don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. And don't fire till you hear the truth through the lies. And don't fire till you know the love in the heart of a mother's son. Until then, please don't fire your gun. I said please, oh please don't fire your gun. Oh please don't fire your gun.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland and 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge and 104.3 FM Albany Corvallis and Eugene are streaming on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. And if you want to, you can hear some of our past shows by going to KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice, which is one word. I'm Marvin. I'm here with Angie.
Good morning.
And today we're going to be speaking with Dawa Goes Behind. He's a 8-year Navy veteran, a houseless advocate and activist, and he is a case manager for houseless veterans and works for Do Good Multnomah, a newly formed nonprofit. Do Good Multnomah is a collective housing project serving houseless veterans in the Gresham area. And before we get started with Dawa, welcome.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome to come here. And Angie's got a few things. And I just wanted to thank everybody for coming to my wife's memorial. And I really appreciate it. So you want to go ahead and...
Sure. There is a rally at Senator Wyden's office to support the Iran deal. That is on Wednesday, August 26th at 12 noon at Senator Wyden's office. His office is located at 911 Northeast 11th Avenue in the Bonneville building at the corner of Northeast 11th and Lloyd. And that's the major announcement I feel like making. I think that we can just talk to Dawa now.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Because that's really important. Like we were talking earlier about the nuclear crap that they're having you know, that the right wingers here are going against. You know, that's very important that we get that. We have to have that, because we do not want a war with Iran. We have enough problems in our own. We don't need a war with Iran. So you want to go ahead and start asking some questions?
Sure. Thanks for coming today, Dawa.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start with just how you've even managed to join the military in the first place. That's usually where the story starts. So when did you join the military? What year and what branch?
Absolutely. Well, I joined the military in 1999. I remember that day like it was yesterday. Me and four of my close friends went to the recruitment office. You know, didn't coming from my neighborhood, there wasn't many options.
Where were you from?
Essentially, I was born on the west side of Chicago.
Yeah.
My grandmother had migrated from New Orleans up to the Chicagoland area, and that's where our family essentially landed and based, and we grew from there. And so, you know, neighborhoods were poor. The you know, the public school systems were, you know, either half or inadequate. And so we wanted to get out. And four of us went to the recruitment office, took the test. I think I was the only one that passed the test, the ASVAB. Mm-hmm. And we each had a decent enough score. And took it and you know, decided that I wanted to join.
So what did you do in the Navy?
My specific job was aviation. I went in as an airman and worked on the amphibious style vessel, and so we supported Marine units.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And you were in for 8 years.
8 years.
You had to enlist for 8 years to get the job you wanted?
You had to enlist for four. You had the option of re-enlisting, because usually that's 4 years, and then you have 4 years inactive.
Mm.
And so later within your career, at the end of your 4 years, you know, most will decide to enlist for four more, so they wouldn't have to do the inactive.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So what did you choose to do? Did you do inactive?
I did active.
You did 4 years active.
I did four more years active, mm-hmm. Yes.
So what did you, when you joined the military initially, what were your thoughts? Did you think you'd be able to work yourself out of poverty and out of these kind of neighborhoods that you thought that didn't really have much of a future for you? How did you see the reality of that?
Yeah.
You know, I knew that I would be able to remove myself from that situation. Mm-hmm. I did not know what the next 4 years would look like. I knew that this situation would be different. Just a little bit about my past is that, you know, I grew up in the systems. When I say systems, you know, I'm talking about juvenile detention centers, foster care, mm-hmm. You know, those systems in itself are complicated in their, you know, in its entirety. And so I was always used to moving and restationing myself into another environment. And so this was just another environment that I was signing up for.
Did you feel like it was a little easier to just fall into that bureaucratic system then of militaristic style living? Like, did it make it easier? Like, you do this and you do that and here's your life and it's set out for you and you don't have to really think much. You just
The structure. Did you have trouble with the structure?
You know, it lined right up to our communities. You knew that you didn't have power in within your community, and you knew where the power lied. And so what you would do is, you know, coming from the communities I come from, is that you lined up to where power was. And a lot of us easily are able to do that, and a lot of us are not. And so In order to make it ahead, you knew you had to either run faster, and or be the best, and so you wouldn't stand out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you like the military?
You know, I excelled. Mm-hmm. I can say that. Mm-hmm. I excelled in my job. I excelled in my position. I excelled in supporting the women and men that were that I was attached to in my division. I sought to be the most qualified in my position, and share what I've learned with others that were coming after me, or mm-hmm. And even, you know, respecting those that were in rank above me, mm-hmm. just being a mediator between either new recruits and higher ranking officials. And so I can say that I excelled.
Mm-hmm. So you tried to have a sense of that community and camaraderie within the military.
It was the best balance to have at that time.
Mm-hmm. Was there any point, so you liked it enough to reenlist or yeah. something, so or it was beneficial enough for you to be
yeah economically yeah. it was a better decision mm-hmm. to because after the 4 years, what we found is like, okay, well, I received my associate's degree in that 4 years. I wanted to continue to use some of the benefits to go after my undergraduate degree. So I used another 4 years to try to get that done. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have to tap into my GI Bill until later. Because mm-hmm. There was a program to where you could use active, if you were active, that was a set of funding for folks that wanted to pursue their college careers while they're active mm-hmm. And not touch the GI Bill until they left.
And when you finally decided to get out of the military.
Yes.
What caused that?
Family was the number one reason. I wanted to see how could I use my military experience into the civilian life. Mm-hmm. And so
So you have a family?
I do.
You have wife and children?
I have a wife now and uh-huh. three children.
Three children?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Good for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, great. That's a good reason for wanting a life out of the military sometimes, because the military is really demanding and can take away from that kind of quality life and quality time with your family too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially if you're deployed a lot. Mm-hmm. Depending on what your job is, you're deployed a lot, you're away from your family
kids,
a lot.
You know, when I was stationed in Japan, I saw that a lot of kids, they were just getting bounced from school to school and country to country and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to wonder if they're able to make those types of close social bonds with their peers like other kids who might be more stationary in one place. And
yeah, you always kind of wonder how that's going to affect, you know, after the military, you know, bouncing around that much. How are you going to be able to make bonds mm-hmm. outside, you know? Because, yeah, you guys traveled a lot, and that's pretty tough.
Yeah.
So I was also wondering, did any of your family other than you were in the military?
You know, no.
Really?
Yes, I was the I think the first within my generation, at least that I know of, that joined up. Yeah. Hmm.
So.
Wow.
You consider yourself an activist and a houseless veterans rights advocate.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And how did that come about? At what point did you get out of the service, and then? Now here you're a resister of oppression, and you are an activist.
Yeah, especially in Oregon, which is
yeah
pretty white.
How does that city
pretty white country.
You have to come here being an activist.
Yeah.
And Oregon will shape you. So it's okay. Well, After it didn't really have to until after after undergraduate. Mm-hmm. After I went to Illinois State University and I was majoring in social work then, I felt like that was the path to go to understand, to further understand the systematic pressures that I went through and how to better alleviate or and to further understand those systems. And so I thought that social work was the best lens into that picture. So after undergrad, I had nothing. I spent the GI Bill was spent.
Goes quick, doesn't it?
It goes really, really fast. Loans, you know, were there, but then there was no transition into, okay, what do I do after this? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the world was changing. You know, we went into the recession at this time. I graduated in 2011. I think around that time, that's when things were very difficult. And trying to get a job in social work was extremely difficult as well. So I found myself out on the streets. Mm. Just graduated, packed a backpack, and hit the streets.
Is this in Oregon?
This was actually in Illinois.
Okay.
And then I moved to, after I graduated from Illinois State, I moved to Madison, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. At the time, the Occupy movement was happening, and Madison was a wildfire. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, with Scott Walker.
They're a real hub of action there.
Right. You had Veterans for Peace out there. Mm-hmm. You had the Teachers Union. It was just a very tension filled city at the time, and the state was just on fire. So I went there because I believe in, I was a firefighter while I was in, so I believe in following the fire. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Madison to see. I knew that someplace I'll find community there or resistors, and I'll be able to be to shape my either my career in social work or meet some other folks, meet some other community members, and we'll see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
That seems almost so simple to just, you spend the GI Bill. You're a college graduate, you were in the Navy for 8 years, and then you found yourself on the street. That just seems like a little bit too of a simple explanation, but unfortunately, that's what it's like for a lot of people who end up in that situation.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with houseless veterans in our area?
How did I get involved?
Yeah.
Well, we're still in Illinois right now.
Yeah.
In our story.
Well, you know, the things I work with vets when I was in the VA while I was in Madison, Wisconsin. I was homeless in Madison for a period, say about 3 to 4 months. And then I found a veteran community there. And then I saw how hard it was for veterans to obtain housing benefits. Mm-hmm. And so that became a heavy interest for me because it was difficult for me to find for any housing. And to be isolated from that community brought on ignited PTSD, ignited so many other things, illnesses and depressions that happen when you are not connected to community.
Mm-hmm.
And so community became really important to me because I found camaraderie again.
Mm-hmm.
I found folks that I could relate to within the veteran community, and we supported each other. So when I found the job, I wanted to use that the access that I had to resources to help my fellow veterans out. And so I got a job at the VA finally, about 4 months. And then I would, my job was a telephone triage. And I would listen to veterans for 8 hours, on a headphone set, 300 calls almost a day.
Is this the Veterans Crisis Line?
Yeah.
You worked for the Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-2.
Well, it was actually telephone triage, was crisis related.
Oh, okay.
And that's what call in, you know, looking for services. And I was just here. You know, the stories for those that are, you know, struggling with some type of either mental disability or physical ailment, looking to locate their doctors, and there were some suicide cases and things like that. So that's when I really began to see like how the veteran community was suffering. And this was coming from a homeless house's perspective, and then working inside the VA hospital. And that's when I became more and more involved in the veteran community.
So you ended up spending 8 hours listening to that. Wow. And that's not just it. That's just one day. How long were you doing that?
I did that for, I think for a period of, I think 6 months, 6 to 7 months doing that.
That would be just so hard.
Oh, you know,
so hard.
I was the youngest and the, in that room, and it was about the size of what we have here, which is about, you know, what, 8 by 10, 12? Yeah. And no windows, just cubicles, and the toughest.
Did you have to call the phone number for yourself?
Well, they would call in, and as soon as you start, it was a 24-hour hotline, and that's what called for services. But the women that were in there were RNs. Registered nurses that were that had been working for the VA for like, you know, 30 years.
Wow.
And so the age was 50 to, you know, 60, 70.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so I was the youngest and the only male in the room.
Wow.
And they were lions. It was like being in the lion's den, because they took it. They took calls like it was, you know, like it was second nature to them.
Mm-hmm.
And being in that position, I just learned how to listen to someone experiencing trauma, not reacting to their trauma, and trying to deliver, you know, connect them or deliver services, you know, in a humane, calm, collective way. And so that's when I learned, like, man, services are really, it's difficult to talk to this veteran right now because he's screaming down my throat right now. Where the hell, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be in a position to just meet that need without, you know, destroying the person.
Mm-hmm.
And so just learning from those RNs has helped me a great deal into how do I reach the cause?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that veteran is experiencing pain, and so where is that pain located? Mm-hmm. Where is that pain, and how can we alleviate it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, did you, like she was, like Andy was saying, you go home and then you call the crisis line after being in pain all day.
You know, what I would do, I would hit the gym. I would kickboxing.
That's a good, probably a good source for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my Thai instructor, he will receive the blunt, you know, of all that I've received.
Yeah.
So.
Andrew was going to give out the, you know, we're talking about the Veterans Crisis Line, and it's 1-800-273-8255, and that's a good to call, because that's a very good,
absolutely
very, very good thing
I've,
for veterans.
I've called them myself. They're good, very helpful.
Start.
And very caring and very, very helpful, you know, to help veterans because of, you know, the stress. And right now, I was talking to Kathleen. I'm getting a lot of calls from veterans out in Washington County and Columbia County area right now, and these men and women are really under stress. What happened is a lot of them got their disability, and they got like 10 years of back pay or 8 years, you know, and they had all this money. And so what they do, they put it in 401ks and IRAs and everything, thinking they're going to be okay. And now the stock market's going down, you know,
yeah.
And these folks are just, you know, they got PTSD. And they're really, you know, freaking out about this. They're really having a really hard time about it.
Yeah.
And boy, I tell you, I got an IRA, and now I'm freaking out about it, you know?
Well, yeah, and that kind of thinking with post-traumatic stress will cause you to have an all-or-nothing extreme type of thinking. And so they will may be inclined to do extreme things or think in ways that are more black and white, more all or nothing than most people.
I caught myself doing that. I caught myself when I found out how much money I had lost, you know, and instantly it was like everything out going into my checking account or everything out going into my savings account. You know, you're right. It's either all or nothing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going
to
be a real
problem. Imagine the transition is difficult to go from veteran to civilian. I mean, there are numerous programs that were created just to help that process. I think one of them was called TAP.
Transitional assistance
program. There we go.
Yeah, isn't that like 5 days, and they teach you what to wear for a job interview?
You're in the military.
Right before you're about to get out, you have to go. You know, they say check this out because it helps you with resume building and some other things. Mm-hmm. But there's also transition into, like, you know, no one's talking to you about the market,
right?
When you get out, you know how the market's going to be shaped and the rise and fall of the economic situation of your country or your state or your local town. And so you're getting out without that training, and you're getting out, you know, without someone showing you the details of the economic situation of your town or your city or your state or your nation. And so that can harm you, especially if you're experiencing PTSD. Especially if you you have a family that you have to that you're the breadwinner for, or that you're the go-to person. And so
that's a lot of pressure.
That's a lot of pressure. Absolutely, a lot of pressure. And I can see why folks are throwing. You know, we say invest, right? Mm-hmm. But invest into what?
Right.
And so that's why housing became important for me, because I began to see that it started at home. And the reason that I joined the military is because of my poor economic status in the first place. And so using it to either gain some discipline, some insight, some travel, get a larger worldview, then going back into my community actually helped me establish, like, this is why my community looks like this. Because I had a different perspective coming back home. And so that does serve veterans well. And so we need to continue to use, I believe we can continue to use structures like that. Talk to veterans about housing, about changing their worldview. Because you, as a veteran, you know, you're the first one on the line to expand U.S. interests.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're the first one. You're the one that's given the gun. You're the one that's given, you know, the training to expand the line. Mm-hmm. And so let's use that community to further, you know, educate ourselves on how this better serve our community, expand in that way. And so using housing, why not invest in housing?
Yeah.
Why not talk to the veterans that are receiving these benefits and saying, like, what if we invested in communities that would better serve veterans? And you can use it in that way, to where you have a buy-in into a community, and that community serves you.
What is, how does that bring into play some of the things that you're working on right now?
Yeah, yes. That's an excellent question. Thank you for asking. The Do Good Multnomah is a newly funded nonprofit, and we the premise is was first to create a shelter that that had no barriers.
Okay.
And so, because most shelters, you have to either go be in some type of program.
Mm-hmm.
That's a program to either, you know, you have to be sober, clean. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to create a shelter situation so where you can just come in for 30 days. You didn't have to be clean, and it'd be minimal case management. We'll help you get to like what we call like a step two.
Mm-hmm.
We also wanted to create a step three, which is like permanent housing.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted to do it differently because usually, as a veteran or even as a houseless person, the first thing, you know, when they say housing first, they're putting you in an apartment building. And they're isolating. Essentially, you're going to be isolated from community.
So that's what housing first means?
Yeah, housing first is to give you keys to a house and then or okay. apartment, and then you will go to the next step will probably get a job.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if once you're stable, you can breathe, you can shower.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have to have that security. Right. If you don't have that kind of security, you're not going to get very far.
Oh, sorry. I keep getting.
I mean, it's just, it's impossible for you to say, you can stay on the street. You can, here's a sleeping bag and an alleyway or something like that. But you got to get up and go to a job interview tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning. That doesn't even make sense.
No. And we were talking a little earlier about remembering back. For men and women, veterans to get into these programs, if you had an alcohol or a drug problem, the first thing they would say was, you got to clean yourself up before you can get in the program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's impossible.
Yeah.
If you're living on the street, there's just no way you're going to be able to do that.
The door is closed
the
in
door
a lot
is
of ways
closed.
Because mm-hmm. why would you want to quit using if that's the only relief from being
right.
Houseless.
Right.
Yeah. Which,
right.
Yeah. And it's not, that's not always the case,
yeah,
but that is some
right.
of the case. Mm-hmm. That is. Mm-hmm. And so meeting folks where they are, that's where we wanted to come from. Exactly where you are, housing first, shelter first,
mm-hmm.
and then work on, you know, those other things later.
Like the life skills building and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Does this include families in your program?
Right now, no.
Mm-hmm.
What we can do, because what we want to do is, if we're talking no barriers, we're talking also, you know, SOs.
Mm-hmm. Meaning?
Sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And since you could be a sex offender, you know, by urinating on the streets.
Right.
You know, but also there's the other end of the spectrum as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that population isn't being housed either. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to eliminate all barriers and invite folks in and then begin to do the community building and life skill coordinating as they're in the community. And so with the shelters, we'll be able to have 12 beds for shelters and another 12 beds for women.
Yeah.
And then at least 50 to 58 individuals into homes.
Mm.
And these homes would be essentially SROs, so you have your single room occupancy, your own bathroom, your own access to a small kitchen and a bed, a closet, but then and that'll be 6 of those rooms into one house, which also have a larger community kitchen and a larger community shared space, so you can build relationships with those that essentially could have the same backgrounds as you.
Right.
Usually veterans don't find themselves in that situation.
Right.
When they get into an apartment building, their neighbor doesn't have veteran experience.
Right. Because now it's what, less than 1% of the population is post 9/11 veterans.
Right.
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 That's very minimal.
That's really nothing.
So,
you know,
this project, how far along is this project?
Right.
And where is it going to be?
Well, we just got our 501c3 status as of 2 weeks ago. We have a developer. which we are willing to build. So we are in the fundraising stage right now. We submitted applications for national funding, local funding, and state funding. NOFAs were released, and so we're out there. We got our rods, and we're casting into deep waters and trying to catch some money. And so that's where we're all right now, and just at the point of where we're talking about the program and to get more exposure.
Where is this going to be located?
Great question. It's going to be located on 61st and Burnside is the site that we're looking at.
61st
and Burnside.
Okay.
161st. Excuse me.
I was going to say, because there's a lot of single family homes right there.
Yeah. A lot.
So this is actually located in Gresham, right on the line of Gresham and Portland.
And that would make it easy for people to be able to get around town, wouldn't
it? That's right.
There's
public access. It's right on the line, on the red and I believe is that blue.
Well, there's a Max station.
Max station, right there.
So that people can get around and things like that. How many people are working on this project as far as the nonprofit end goes?
Well, I would say right now our art renderer, he's fresh out of just graduated last year, so this is like his first project. And
what did he graduate from with?
He graduated with his I think architectural degree. And his name's Carlos Anthony. And he just hopped on board, was a friend of mine, a friend of a friend's of an artist. And so our art renderer, which is, he's pouring a lot into the program. Our Chris Ayosa, which was used to be my supervisor when in case management, he quit and began to work on Do Good Monoma after he hired me. And then we came up with this program. He's like, I'm out of here. Let's go and create this thing. So that's really funny. And then myself, and then we have a developer that's also working on it.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a website that people can go to?
Yes.
Oh, that's great.
DoGoodMonoma.org.
Okay.
You can check it out there.
All right.
DoGoodMonoma.org?
Yes.
Okay. I was reading some stuff earlier about on the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans website. And it says that, let's see here, roughly 8% are female veterans, and
8% are homeless. Of female veterans are homeless.
Okay, says the Department of Veterans Affairs states that the nation's homeless veterans are predominantly male, with roughly 8% being female. The majority are single, live in urban areas, and suffer from mental illness, alcohol, and or substance abuse.
Sexual trauma, probably.
Right, and that can contribute to the mental illness. Right. Or co-occurring disorders. About 12% of the adult homeless populations are veterans. Roughly 40% of all homeless veterans are African American or Hispanic.
How many? 40?
Roughly 40%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are African American or Hispanic, despite only accounting for 10.4%
the population
and 3.4% of the U.S. veteran population. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge disproportionate issue with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Because women, Hispanics, and African Americans,
And another thing I was reading about this was that there's a growing problem of seeing more and more families ending up on the street.
Yeah.
As in, a veteran is, and we were talking about this earlier a little bit, there's a veteran that's the primary breadwinner. They might lose their job, or they're in a program through the VA where they have to be, it's zero tolerance as far as drugs and alcohol goes, and then they relapse if they have a substance abuse, and then their whole family ends up getting kicked out of this program and ends up on the street. What kind of situations do you hear from people?
Yeah, what are you hearing about
I was a case manager, and as a case manager, I have a caseload of 33, which is really fair. There's some caseloads out there that's 60 plus. And the percentage of those that will come to me, we will look at, say, 50% of those would be families. Hmm. It means that the head of household had a spouse, or was either a single parent, or had some other people that depended on their benefits, mm-hmm, in order to move forward, in order to stabilize themselves. I wanted to kind of go back to like the 8% of women veterans. And it's funny because I believe that that percentage is more.
Oh, right.
I do, but too. When, I'm with you.
I think so as
at
well.
The same time, like, you know, like to be a soldier, right? Mm-hmm. To be what we consider as in Native communities, you know, war tribes, you know, to, mm-hmm, be a warrior, that's like, you know, it's always thrown on the men, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. But to be a veteran, it's, you sometimes don't want to own up to that, especially, right, if your experience was not the best.
If you were betrayed.
Exactly, exactly. And so I believe that that percentage, because, you know, women have been betrayed specifically, you know, in service. And so, and we could talk about, that's a whole nother show.
Yeah, it right. is.
And all right. We've had a couple of those as well. But yeah, they, many times women don't self-identify as veterans. You have to kind of pull and prod it out of them. Right. And I know a female veteran, for example, that she worked in her work setting for something like 4 or 5 years, and nobody knew she was a veteran until she mentioned it one day. But sometimes women just never mention that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of the trauma that's related to being a veteran, being, yeah, a woman veteran. And so I believe that it is higher. And the reason that they're not coming out because we don't have the programs essentially to address those issues, and so if we did have the programs to address those issues, then I believe that percentage of the census would be higher. They're higher in the African and Latino community because that's one way to get benefits. Once you say that you're a veteran, you get a little bit of maybe some health care. You could
sometimes a preference for a job.
Absolutely.
Something. Mm-hmm.
So you have your fingers in a lot in order to receive a lot. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people, especially males, if you're gonna say that you're a veteran because it's gonna open up, you know, some doors for you to get some type of resources or funding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, I found that when sometimes with even identifying as a female veteran, sometimes the response you get is almost enough to wish you hadn't even said it, because
absolutely,
people will say, oh, well, you're too young, you're too attractive, you're too this or that, whatever reason. Or I've called the VA before and they've asked me what branch my husband was in. I don't have one, but
right. It's not even the acknowledgement that you know, you served. And then so,
or there's that case about that girl that pulled into female veteran that pulled into the veteran's parking spot in Home Depot. Hmm. And then she ended up getting a nasty note written on her car and left there saying, did you hear about that?
I didn't.
Home Depot has these parking spots for honor our veterans or whatever, that's what they say. And so she parked in one, went and got something, came back out, and then she's got this nasty note left on her car saying, this spot's for veterans. And she was in the Air Force for like 8 or 10 years or something like that, you know, and it's just amazing. But
the look of a veteran today is not, you know, the World War II veteran with the hat and you know, his ship or his unit that he was, you know, connected to, or the Navy veteran, the 60s Vietnam era. That is still a population, but
The new folks are different.
It's a big difference. Post 9/11 is essentially, you know, a big number of our population, and these guys would be, and you're going to be working around them. That's more post 9/11 veterans than there were Vietnam veterans.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, the women veterans is really, we've done a lot of shows on them because that's so important to us. And one of the things, I talked to an organization down in Southern California that worked with women veterans, and they were saying that that most of the women they were starting to work with now are African American. Most of them were sexually abused in the military. Most of them are divorced. Most of them have at least one or two children, and they all of them had a drug or alcohol problem.
Wow.
And they said that more and more, as the economy was getting worse and worse, more and more women were needing help that had been in the military. So you know, Dawa, that 8%, you're right. It's a lot higher than that.
Absolutely.
It's a lot higher than that.
How will they fit in with the housing project?
You know, I hope that we can create more of structures like this. We're trying to start it cooperative perspective, egalitarian perspective. Even our board is collective. Angie, we invite Angie to be on the board.
I am a non-paid board member.
That's right.
Good.
Yes,
she'll be a good one.
I'm the only female veteran on there.
As of right now, and
but
so
hopefully
we,
there's more, right?
Yes,
yeah, Penny.
Yeah, hey Penny.
And
come
so
on.
We're trying to get more women veterans on board, and specifically that are African descent and indigenous and Latino, because those perspectives are needed, especially at a egalitarian structure and a cooperative structure. And so we starting there would help. We believe. Would help guide this project to be self-sustainable. If the board is cooperative, then the community would also be cooperative at some point. And so how that would fit into play is that we may not be able to house women in this particular project, but if this project is successful, then we can use it as a model,
right?
To focus on a housing specifically for families, the living cooperative environments, and for women,
and where children can be present as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, and that's why we can't be present in this one because it's a low barrier, supporting SO community, and if that's a tough population and one of the biggest populations to serve, and so we're sinking our teeth into like a pretty big chunk.
Yeah, you are.
And so if we can show that we could, you know, manage that, then future projects is like, okay, well, this is a easier essentially population to deal with, you know, let's expand.
And you have to start somewhere.
Absolutely.
There was something that I found pretty interesting, your definition for the housing projects, if you're allowed to participate in this, what your definition of a veteran is. And I believe you said it was one day. You had to serve one day.
One day.
Good for you.
One day. One day. You signed up to serve that one day. We're even trying to serve folks that do not have a honorable discharge.
Uh-huh. See, that's really important
That would be like Scott Olson that we interviewed, who he was given an other than honorable or a dishonorable or something like that.
Other than honorable, yeah. Right.
And they said that they gave him a false positive on a drug test and all that stuff, and he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's all these people who have these other than honorable or less than honorable discharges.
Yeah,
specifically. That can't get anything.
Specifically LGBTQ communities.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the don't ask, don't tell is just, that's a recent policy was just turned over. And so if you were LGBTQ, you kept it hush, and if you were found out, you were not given an honorable discharge.
What a huge problem.
Huge problem. And wow. So you know, if you're getting out and you're still maybe battling that, then this organization like this and organizations like this could serve you.
Yeah.
How would people who were given an OTH or other than honorable for being LGBTQ, can they overturn that at some point? Do they have to go through the process?
There's a big process you have to go through.
It depends on the state. Yeah.
Big process. Yeah.
What a nightmare.
Yeah. See, that happened in Vietnam.
You might as well build another housing project.
Yeah. That happened in Vietnam. There's a whole bunch of guys coming out of Vietnam that got less than honorable discharges, you know, that had spent their year combat in Vietnam, got in trouble, maybe drugs or whatever, or you know, and got less than honorable discharges. Mm-hmm. And a lot, and mostly in African American or Latino communities, and it's a big, huge, long process to get that changed.
What a nightmare!
Because what they were saying, what the VA was saying, and some of these right wing organizations like VFW and American Legion, and all these, you know, they're right wing. Let's just admit it.
White wing, white.
You know. I always do that too.
White right wing Republicans, you know. And they were saying, all these guys, they're just trying to do this so they can get benefits. Well, yeah, they served, you know.
Right.
They served. They deserve those benefits. And that's a real problem. That's really a problem.
Absolutely.
One day, doesn't matter what the discharge was or, you know, that's a good point. That's a selling point for you.
What are some of the things that that people can do if they want to help the veteran, the houseless veteran population?
Get involved in some organization that's either advocating for these issues or working on these issues. Do good Multnomah. Check out the website.
Yeah.
Check out there's a, you know, a tab. You can find out more information. You can donate whatever. Just get involved. You can get in contact with me. I can either leave my contact information. We need more veterans and more advocates to talk about these issues.
Yeah. There's a really good organization. I don't know if you've heard about it, but about 20 years ago, I think, we interviewed them. It's called Black Veterans for Social Justice back in New York City. Mm-hmm. They have it down. And they're just amazing, and that would be a good one to look at.
What is the name of that again?
They were called Black Veterans for Social Justice.
Okay.
Yeah, they were just amazing. We interviewed them, and it was just like they were taking everybody, you know, that was going. And it started out as black, but, you know, I mean, they opened
did
up.
Did you get them on the phone, or did they come?
We talked to them on the phone. Mm-hmm. We talked to them on the phone. In fact, one of a friend of mine had gone back to New York. I think they were in Brooklyn. And she had gone back and talked to them and seen their program. And it's an amazing program for that. So,
what is the reason to use the terminology houseless versus homeless?
Well, you know, we get that. That's an amazing question. Thank you. Because, you know, we need houses.
Mm-hmm.
The home is essentially, where the heart is.
Right.
And so, you know, your wherever you are essentially is your home, your surrounding. But to have a house, you know, to have a community, that's what you don't have.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have houses.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have communities. So we are communityless and we're houseless.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever we are, we make that home.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it's kind of humanizing the person again who doesn't have the house.
Absolutely.
Well, Dawa, I'm sorry. I told you it was going to go fast, buddy. So we'll be back on Friday, September 18th at 9 a.m. And this is Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. And there it is.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of British Wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore.
killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we want with a saber and a gun.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City Hall at 6 p.m. with a rally and ends at the Multnomah County Building with another assembly. The theme will be Housing Rights for All and will encompass everything from homelessness to affordable housing to tenants' rights to at-cost public housing. More information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events or portlandrentersassembly.info.
You gotta fight for your rights!
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 a.m. Coming up, it's Chris Andre with Air Cascadia, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints. At 11 on the Radio Zine, host Jennifer Kemp speaks with journalist Lou Urenick about his book, The Great Fire. And at 11:30 from the archives, we hear Follow the Garbage. We'll hear more about that later. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today.